The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the 15th reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. I'm Anna McLean. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. Isabel is captured and tortured and asks repeatedly, who is Nightingale? They do not believe her when she tells them she is Nightingale. Her father appears and tells them he is Nightingale. He is brought outside and shot. Meanwhile, Von Richter threatens to kill Jan's children if she does not submit to him. Then he rapes her. Now we continue with the Nightingale. She had to help Isabel. Don't come back. I'll turn you in myself. And Papa, if she could. She boarded the train and sat on a wooden bench in the third-class carriage. Several of the other passengers, mostly women, sat with their heads down, hands clasped in their laps. A tall Hauptsturmführer stood guard by the door, his gun at the ready. A squad of narrow-eyed Millies, the brutal Vichy police, sat in another part of the carriage. Vian didn't look at either of the women in the compartment with her. One of them stank of garlic and onions. The smell made Vian faintly sick in the hot, airless compartment. Fortunately, her destination was not far away, and just after 10 o'clock in the morning, she disembarked at the small train station on the outskirts of Giron. Now what? The sun rode high overhead, baking the small town into a stupor. Vian clutched her handbag close, felt perspiration crawl down her back and drip from her temples. Many of the sand-colored buildings had been bombed. Piles of rubble were everywhere. A blue cross of Lorraine had been painted onto the stone sides of an abandoned school. She encountered few people on the crooked cobblestone streets. Now and then a girl on a bicycle or a boy with a wheelbarrow would thump and rattle past her, but for the most part what she noticed was the silence, an air of desertion. Then a woman screamed. Vian came round the last crooked corner and saw the town square. A dead body was lashed to the fountain in the square. Blood red in the water that lapped around his ankles. His head had been strapped back with an army belt, so that he seemed almost relaxed there, with his mouth slack, his eyes open, sightless. Bullet holes chewed up his chest, left his sweater in tatters. Blood darkened his chest and pant legs. Her father. Isabel had spent last night huddled in the damp, black corner of her cell. The horror of her father's death replayed itself over and over. She would be killed soon, of that she had no doubt. As the hours passed, time measured in breaths taken and released, in heartbeats, she wrote imaginary letters of goodbye to her father, to Gaetan, to Vian. She strung her memories into sentences that she memorized or tried to, but they all ended with, "I'm sorry." When the soldiers came for her, iron keys rattling in ancient locks, worm-eaten doors scraping open across the uneven floor, she wanted to scream and protest, yell no, but she had no voice left. She was yanked to her feet. A woman built like a panzer tank thrust shoes and socks at her and said something in German. Obviously, she didn't speak French. She gave Isabel back her Juliet identity papers. They were stained now and crumpled. The shoes were too small and pinched her toes, but Isabel was grateful for them. The woman hauled her out of the cell and up the uneven stone steps and out into the blinding sunlight of the square. Several soldiers stood by the opposite buildings, their rifles strapped to their backs, going about their business. She saw her father's bullet-ridden dead body lashed to the fountain and screamed. Everyone in the square looked up. The soldiers laughed at her, pointed. "Quiet," the German tank woman hissed. Isabel was about to say something when she saw Vian moving toward her. Her sister moved forward awkwardly, as if she wasn't quite in control of her body. She wore a tattered dress that Isabel remembered as once being pretty. Her red-gold hair was dull and lank, tucked behind her ears. Her face was as thin and hollow as a bone china teacup. "I've come to help you," Vian said quietly. Isabel could have cried. More than anything in the world, she wanted to run to her big sister. to drop to her knees and beg for forgiveness, and then to hold her in gratitude, to say, "I'm sorry, and I love you," and all the words in between. But she couldn't do any of that. She had to protect Vianne. "So did he," she said, cocking her head toward her father. "Go away, please, forget me." The German woman yanked Isabel forward. She stumbled along, her feet screaming in pain, not allowing herself to look back. She thought she was being led to a firing squad, but when she went past her father's slumped body and out of the square and onto a side street where a lorry was waiting. The woman shoved Isabel into the back of the lorry. She scrambled back to the corner and squatted down, alone. The canvas flaps unfurled, bringing darkness. As the engine roared to life, she rested her chin in the hard and empty valley between her bony knees and closed her eyes. When she woke, it was to stillness. The truck had stopped moving. Somewhere, a whistle blared. The flaps of the truck were whisked sideways, and light flooded into the back of the truck. So bright, Isabel couldn't see anything but shadow men coming toward her, yelling, "Schnell! Schnell!" She was pulled out of the truck and tossed through the cobblestone street like a sack of trash. There were four empty cattle cars lined up along the platform. The first three were shut tightly. The fourth was open and crammed with women and children. The noise was overwhelming, screaming, crying, dogs barking, soldiers shouting, whistles blaring, the chugging hum of the waiting train. The Nazis shoved Isabel into the crowd, pushing her forward every time she stopped until the last carriage appeared in front of her. He picked her up and threw her inside. She stumbled into the crowd, almost fell. Only the other bodies kept her on her feet. They were still coming in, stumbling forward, crying, clutching their children's hands, trying to find a 6-inch opening between bodies in which to stand. Iron bars covered the windows. In the corner, Isabel saw a single barrel, their toilet. Suitcases were piled in the corner on a stack of hay bales. Limping on feet that ached with every step, Isabel pushed through the crowd of whimpering, crying women, past their screaming children, to the back of the train carriage. In the corner, she saw a woman standing alone, her arms crossed defiantly across her chest, her coarse gray hair covered by a black scarf. Madame Babineau's bruised face broke into a brown-toothed smile. Isabel was so relieved by the sight of her friend that she almost cried. "Madame Babineau," Isabel whispered, hugging her friend tightly. "I think it's time you call me Micheline," her friend said. She was dressed in men's pants that were too long for her and a flannel work shirt. She touched Isabel's cracked, bruised, bloodied face. "What have they done to you?" "They're worse," she said, trying to sound like herself. "I think not." Micheline let that sink in a moment and then cocked her head toward a bucket near her booted feet. This one was filled with a gray water that sloshed over the edges as the wooden floor rattled beneath so many moving bodies. A split wooden ladle lay to one side. "Drink while it's there." Isabel filled the ladle with the fetid-smelling water. Gagging at the taste, she forced herself to swallow. She stood, offered a ladle full to Micheline, who drank it all and wiped her wet lips with the back of her sleeve. "This is going to be bad," Micheline said. "I'm sorry I got you into this," Isabel said. "You did not get me into anything, Juliet," Micheline said. "I wanted to be a part of it." The whistle sounded again, and the car doors banged shut, plunging them all into darkness. Bolts clanged into place, locking them in. The train lurched forward. People fell into one another, fell down. Babies screamed and children whined. Someone was peeing in the bucket, and the smell overlaid the stench of the sweat and fear. Micheline put an arm around Isabel, and the two women climbed to the top of the hay bales and sat together. "I am Isabel Rossignol," she said quietly, hearing her name swallowed by the darkness. If she was going to die on this train, she wanted someone to know who she was. Micheline sighed. "You are Julianne and Madeleine's daughter? Did you know from the start? Oui, you have your mother's eyes and your father's temperament." "He was executed," she said. "He admitted to being the Nightingale." Micheline held her hand. "Of course he did. Some day, when you are a mother, you will understand. I remember thinking your parents were unmatched, quiet, intellectual Julianne, and your vivacious steel-spined Maman. I thought they had nothing in common, but now I know how often love is like that. It was the war, you know. It broke him like a cigarette. Irreparable. She tried to save him. So hard. When she died, we, instead of fixing himself, he drank and made himself worse. But the man he became was not the man he was, Micheline said. Some stories don't have happy endings, even love stories, maybe especially love stories. The hours roll by slowly. Often the train stopped to take on more women and children or to avoid bombing. The women took turns sitting down and standing up, each helping the others when they could. The water disappeared and the urine barrel overflowed, sloshing over. Whenever the train slowed, Isabel pushed to the sides of the carriage, peering through the slats, trying to see where they were, but all she saw were more soldiers and dogs and whips, more women being herded like cattle into more train cars. Women wrote their names on scraps of paper or cloth and shoved them through cracks in the carriage walls, hoping against hope to be remembered. By the second day, they were all exhausted and hungry and so thirsty they remained quiet, saving their saliva. The heat and stench in the carriage was unbearable. Be afraid. Wasn't that what Gaetan had said to her? He said the warning had come from Vienne that night in the barn. Isabel hadn't fully understood it then. She understood it now. She had thought herself indestructible. But what would she have done differently? Nothing, she whispered into the darkness. She would do it all again. And this wasn't the end. She had to remember that. Each day she lived, there was a chance for salvation. She couldn't give up. She could never give up. The train stopped. Isabel sat up, bleary-eyed, her body aching and in pain from the beatings of her interrogation. She heard harsh voices, dogs barking. A whistle blared. "Wake up, Micheline," Isabel said, gently jostling the woman beside her. Micheline edged upright. The 70 other people in the car, women and children, slowly roused themselves from the stupor of the journey. Those who were seated rose. The women came together instinctively, packed in closer. Isabel winced in pain as she stood on torn feet in shoes too small. She held Micheline's cold hand. The giant carriage doors rumbled open. Sunlight poured in, blinding them all. Isabel saw SS officers, dressed in black with their snarling, barking dogs. They were shouting orders at the women and children, incomprehensible words with obvious meanings. Climb down, move on, get into line. The women helped one another down. Isabel held on to Micheline's hand and stepped down onto the platform. A truncheon hit her in the head so hard she stumbled sideways and dropped to her knees. Get up, a woman said. You must. Isabel let herself be helped to her feet. Dizzy, she leaned into the woman. Micheline came up on the other side, put an arm around her waist to steady her. To Isabel's left, a whipped snake through the air, hissing and cracked into the fleshy pink of a woman's cheek. The woman screamed and held the torn skin of her cheek together. Blood poured between her fingers, but she kept moving. The women formed ragged lines and marched across uneven ground through an open gate that was surrounded by barbed wire. A watchtower loomed above them. Inside the gates, Isabel saw hundreds, thousands of women who looked like ghosts moving through a surreal landscape of gray, their bodies emaciated, their eyes sunken and dead-looking in gray faces, their hair shorn. They wore baggy, dirty, striped dresses. Some were barefooted, only women and children, no men. Behind the gates and beneath the watchtower, she saw barracks stretching out in lines. A corpse of a woman lay in the mud in front of them. Isabel stepped over the dead woman, too numb to think anything but keep moving. The last woman who'd stopped had been hit so hard that she didn't get up again. Soldiers yanked the suitcases from their hands, snatched necklaces, pulled earrings and wedding rings off. When their valuables were all gone, they were led into a room where they stood crowded together, sweating from the heat, dizzy from thirst. A woman grabbed Isabel's arms, pulled her aside. Before she could even think, she was being stripped, naked. They all were. Rough hands scratched her skin with dirty fingernails. She was shaved everywhere, under her arms, her head, and her pubic hair, with a viciousness that left her bleeding. Schnell! Isabel stood with the other shaved, freezing, naked women, her feet aching, her head still ringing from the blows. And then they were being moved again, herded forward toward another building. She remembered suddenly the story she heard at MI9 and on the BBC, news stories about Jewish people being gassed to death at the concentration camps. She felt a feeble sense of panic as she shuffled forward with the herd into a giant room full of showerheads. Isabel stood beneath one of the showerheads, naked and trembling. Over the noise of the guards and the prisoners and the dogs, she heard the rattling of an old ventilation system. Something was coming on, clattering through the pipes. This is it. The doors of the building banged shut. Ice-cold water gushed from the showerheads, shocking Isabel, chilling her to the bone. In no time it was over, and they were being herded again, shivering, trying futilely to cover her nakedness with her trembling hands. She moved into the crowd and stumbled forward with the other women. One by one, they were deloused. Then Isabel was handed a shapeless striped dress and a dirty pair of men's underwear and two left shoes without laces. Clutching her new possessions to her clammy breasts, she was shoved into a barn-like building with stacks of wooden bunks. She climbed into one of the bunks and lay there with nine other women. Moving slowly, she dressed and then lay back, staring up at the gray wooden underside of the bunk above her. "Micheline," she whispered. "I'm here, Isabel," her friend said from the bunk above. Isabel was too tired to say more. Outside, she heard the smacking of leather belts, the hissing of whips, and the screams of women who moved too slowly. "Welcome to Ravensbrück," said the woman beside her. Isabel felt the woman's skeletal hip against her leg. She closed her eyes, trying to block out the sounds, the smell, the fear, the pain. "Stay alive," she thought. "Stay alive." Chapter 35. August. Vianne breathed as quietly as she could. In the hot, muggy darkness of this upstairs bedroom, her bedroom, the one she shared with Antoine, every sound was amplified. She heard the bedsprings ping in protest as von Richter rolled onto his side. She watched his exhalations, gauging each one. When he started to snore, she inched sideways and peeled the damp sheet away from her naked body. In the last few months, Vianne had learned about pain and shame and degradation. She knew about survival, too, how to gauge von Richter's moods, and when to stay out of his way, and when to be silent. Sometimes, if she did everything just right, he barely saw her. It was only when he'd had a bad day, when he came home already angry, that she was in trouble, like last night. He'd come home in a terrible temper, muttering about the fighting in Paris. The Marquis had started fighting in the streets. Vianne had known instantly what he'd want that night, to inflict pain. She'd herded her children out of the room quickly, put them to bed in the downstairs bedroom. Then she'd gone upstairs. That was the worst of it, maybe, that he made her come to him, and she did. She took off her clothes so he wouldn't rip them away. Now, as she dressed, she noticed how much it hurt to raise her arms. She paused at the blacked-out window. Beyond it lay fields destroyed by incendiary bombs, trees broken in half, many of them still smoldering, gates and chimneys broken, an apocalyptic landscape. The airfield was a crushed pile of stone and wood surrounded by broken aeroplanes and bombed-out lorries. Since General de Gaulle had taken over the Free French Army and the Allies had landed in Normandy, the bombing of Europe had become constant. Was Antoine out there still? Was he somewhere in his prison camp, looking out a slit in the barracks wall or a boarded-up window, looking at this moon that had once shone on a house filled with love? And Isabel, she had been gone only 2 months, but it felt like a lifetime. Vianne worried about her constantly, but there was nothing to be done about worry. It had to be borne. Downstairs she lit a candle. The electricity had been off for a long time now. In the water closet, she set the candle down by the sink and stared at herself in the oval mirror. Even in candlelight, she looked pasty and gaunt. Her dull reddish-gold hair hung limp on either side of her face. In the years of deprivation, her nose seemed to have lengthened, and her cheekbones had become more prominent. A bruise discolored her temple. Soon she knew it would darken. She knew without looking that there would be handprints on her upper arms and an ugly bruise on her left breast. He was getting meaner, angrier. The Allied forces had landed in southern France and begun liberating towns. The Germans were losing the war, and von Richter seemed hell-bent on making Vianne pay for it. She stripped and washed in tepid water. She scrubbed until her skin was mottled and red, and still she didn't feel clean. She never felt clean. When she could stand no more, she dried off and redressed in her nightgown, adding a robe over it. Tying it at the waist, she left the bathroom, carrying her candle. Sophie was in the living room, waiting for her. She sat on the last good piece of furniture in the room, the divan, with her knees drawn together and her hands clasped. The rest of the furniture had been requisitioned or burned. "What are you doing up so late? I could ask you the same question, but I don't really need to, do I?" Vianne tightened the belt on her robe. It was a nervous habit, something to do with her hands. Sophie looked up at her. At almost 14, Sophie's face had begun to mature. Her eyes were black against her pale skin, her lashes lush and long. A poor diet had thinned Sophie's hair, but it still hung in ringlets. She pursed her full lips. "Really, maman? How long must we pretend?" The sadness and the anger in those beautiful eyes was heartbreaking. Vianne, apparently, had hidden nothing from this child who lost her childhood to war. What was the right thing for a mother to say to her nearly grown daughter about the ugliness in the world? How could she be honest? How could Vianne expect her daughter to judge her less harshly than she judged herself? Vianne sat down beside Sophie. She thought about their old life. Laughter, kisses, family suppers, Christmas mornings, lost baby teeth, first words. "I'm not stupid," Sophie said. "I have never thought you were, not for a moment." She drew in a breath and let it out. "I only wanted to protect you. From the truth, from everything." "There's no such thing," Sophie said bitterly. "Don't you know that by now? Rachel is gone, Sarah is dead, Grandpère is dead, Tante Isabel is..." Tears filled her eyes. "And Papa, when did we last hear from him? A year, 8 months? He's probably dead, too." "Your father is alive. So is your aunt. I'd feel it if they were gone." She put a hand over her heart. "I'd know it here." "Your heart? You'd feel it in your heart?" Vianne knew that Sophie was being shaped by this war, roughened by fear and desperation into a sharper, more cynical version of herself, but still it was hard to see in such sharp detail. "How can you just go to him? I see the bruises." "That's my war," Vianne said quietly, ashamed almost more than she could stand. "Tante Isabel would have strangled him in his sleep." "Oui," she agreed. "Isabel is a strong woman. I am not. I am just a mother trying to keep her children safe." "You think we want you to save us this way?" "You're young," she said, her shoulders slumping in defeat. "When you are a mother yourself..." "I won't be a mother," she said. "I'm sorry to have disappointed you, Sophie." "I want to kill him," Sophie said after a moment. "Me too. We could hold a pillow over his head while he sleeps." "You think I have not dreamed of doing it? But it is too dangerous. Beck already disappeared while living in this house. To have a second officer do the same, they would turn their attention on us, which we don't want." Sophie nodded glumly. "I can stand what von Richter does to me, Sophie. I couldn't stand losing you or Danielle or being sent away from you or seeing you hurt." Sophie didn't look away. "I hate him." "So do I," Vianne said quietly. "So do I." "It is hot out today. I was thinking it would be a good day for swimming," Vianne said with a smile. The uproar was immediate and unanimous. Vianne guided the children out of the orphanage classroom, keeping them tucked in close as they walked down the cloisters. They were passing Mother Superior's office when the door opened. "Madame Mauriac," Mother said, smiling, "your little gaggle looks happy enough to burst into song." "Not on a day this hot, Mother." She linked her arm through Mother's. "Come to the pond with us. A thoroughly lovely sea on a September day." "Single file," Vianne said to the children as they reached the main road. The children immediately fell into line. Vianne started them off on a song, and they picked it up instantly, singing loudly as they clapped and bounced and skipped. Did they even notice the bombed-out buildings they passed, the smoking piles of rubble that had once been homes? Or was destruction the ordinary view of their childhoods, unremarkable, unnoticeable? Daniel, as always, stayed with Vianne, clinging to her hand. He was like that lately, afraid to be apart from her for long. Sometimes it bothered her, even broke her heart. She wondered if there was a part of him, deep down, that remembered all that he had lost, the mother, the father, the sister. She worried that when he slept, curled up against her side, he was Ari, the boy left behind. Vianne clapped her hands. Children, you are to cross the street in an orderly fashion. Sophie, you are my leader. The children crossed the street carefully and then raced up the hill to the wide seasonal pond that was one of Vianne's favorite places. Antoine had first kissed her at this very spot. At the water's edge, the students started stripping down. In no time, they were in the water. She looked down at Daniel. Do you want to go play in the water with your sister? Daniel chewed his lower lip, watching the children splash in the still blue water. I don't know. You don't have to swim if you don't want to. You could just get your feet wet. He frowned, his round cheeks bunched in consideration. Then he let go of her hand and walked cautiously towards Sophie. He still clings to you, Mother said. He has nightmares, too, Vianne was about to say. Lord knows I do, when nausea hit. She mumbled, excuse me, and ran through the tall grass to a copse of trees where she bent over and vomited. There was almost nothing in her stomach, but the dry heaves went on and on, leaving her feeling weak and exhausted. She felt Mother's hand on her back, rubbing her, soothing her. Vianne straightened. She tried to smile. I'm sorry, I don't... She stopped. The truth washed over her. She turned to Mother. I threw up yesterday morning. Oh, no, Vianne. A baby? Vianne didn't know whether to laugh or cry or scream at God. She had prayed and prayed for another child to grow in her womb. But not now. Not his. Vianne hadn't slept in a week. She felt rickety and tired and terrified, and her morning sickness had gotten even worse. Now she sat at the edge of the bed, looking down at Daniel. At 5, he was outgrowing his pajamas again. Skinny wrists and ankles stuck out from the frayed sleeves and pant legs. Unlike Sophie, he had never complained about being hungry or reading by candlelight, or the terrible gray bread their rations provided. He remembered nothing else. Hey, Captain Dan, she said, pushing the damp black curls out of his eyes. He rolled onto his back and grinned up at her, showing off his missing front teeth. Maman, I dreamed there was candy. The door to the bedroom banged open. Sophie appeared, breathing hard. Come quick, Maman. Oh, Sophie, I am. Now. Come on, Daniel. She looks serious. He surged at her exuberantly. He was too big for her to carry, so she hugged him tightly and then withdrew. She retrieved the only clothes that fit him, a pair of canvas pants that had been made from painter's cloth she'd found in the barn, and a sweater she'd knitted with precious blue wool. When he was dressed, she took his hand and led him into the living room. The front door was standing open. Bells were ringing, church bells. It sounded as if music were playing somewhere. The Marseillaise? On a Tuesday at 9 in the morning? Outside, Sophie stood beneath the apple tree. A line of Nazis marched past the house. Moments later came the vehicles. Tanks and lorries and automobiles rumbled past Le Jardin, one after another, churning up dust. A black Citroen pulled over to the side of the road and parked. Von Richter got out and came to her, his boots dirty, his eyes hidden behind black sunglasses, his mouth drawn into a thin, angry line. Madame Mauriac, Herr Sturmbannführer, we are leaving your sorry, sickly little town. She didn't speak. If she had, she would have said something that could get her killed. This war isn't over, he said, but whether this was for her benefit or his own, she wasn't sure. His gaze flicked past Sophie and landed on Daniel. Vianne stood utterly still, her face impassive. He turned to her. The newest bruise on her cheek made him smile. Von Richter, someone in the entourage yelled, leave your French whore behind. That's what you were, you know, he said. She pressed her lips together to keep from speaking. I'll forget you, he leaned forward. I wonder if you can say the same. He marched into the house and came out again, carrying his leather valise. Without a glance at her, he returned to his automobile. The door slammed shut behind him. Vianne reached for the gate to steady herself. "They're leaving," Sophie said. Vianne's legs gave out. She crumpled to her knees. "He's gone." Sophie knelt beside Vianne and held her tightly. Daniel ran barefooted through the patch of dirt between them. "Me too," he yelled. "I want a hug." He threw himself into them so hard they toppled over, fell into the dry grass. In the months since the Germans had left Karavo, there was good news everywhere about the Allied victories, but the war hadn't ended. Germany hadn't surrendered. The blackout had been softened to a dim out, so the windows let in light again, a surprising gift. But still, Vianne couldn't relax. Without von Richter on her mind, she would never say his name out loud again, not as long as she lived, but she couldn't stop thinking about him. She was obsessed with worry for Isabel and Rachel and Antoine. She wrote Antoine a letter almost every day and stood in line to mail them, even though the Red Cross reported that no mail was getting through. They hadn't heard from him in more than a year. "You're pacing again, maman," Sophie said. She was seated at the divan, snuggled up with Daniel, a book open between them. On the fireplace mantel were a few of the photographs Vianne had brought in from the cellar in the barn. It was one of the few things she could think to do to make Le Jardin a home again. "Maman?" Sophie's voice brought Vianne back to herself. "He's coming home," Sophie said, "and so is Tante Isabel." "Mais oui." "What will we tell Papa?" Sophie asked. And Vianne knew by the look in Sophie's eyes that she'd wanted to ask this for a while. Vianne placed a hand on her still flat abdomen. There was no sign of the baby yet, but Vianne knew her body well. A life was growing within her. She left the living room and went to the front door, pushing it open. Barefooted, she stepped down on the cracked stone steps, feeling the soft moss on the bottoms of her feet. Taking care not to step on a sharp rock, she walked out to the road and turned toward town, kept walking. The cemetery appeared on her right. It had been ruined by a bomb blast 2 months ago. Aged stone markers lay on their sides, split in pieces. The ground was cracked and broken, with gaping holes here and there. Skeletons hung from the tree branches, bones clattering in the breeze. In the distance, she saw a man coming around the bend in the road. In years to come, she would ask herself what had drawn her out here on this hot autumn day at exactly this hour. But she knew. Antoine. She started to run, heedless of her bare feet. It wasn't until she was almost in his arms, close enough to reach out, that she stopped suddenly, drew herself up short. He would take one look at her and know she had been ruined by another man. "Vianne," he said, in a voice she barely recognized. "I escaped." He was so changed. His face had sharpened, and his hair had gone gray. White stubble covered his hollow cheeks and jawline, and he was so terribly thin. His left arm hung at an odd angle, as if it had been broken and badly reset. He was thinking the same of her. She could see it in his eyes. His name came out in a whisper of breath. Antoine. She felt the sting of tears and saw that he was crying too. She went to him, kissed him, but when he drew back, he looked like a man she'd never seen before. "I can do better," he said. She took his hand. More than anything, she wanted to feel close to him, connected, but the shame of what she'd endured created a wall between them. "I thought of you every night," he said as they walked toward home. "I imagined you in our bed, thought of how you looked in that white nightgown. I knew you were as alone as I was." Vianne couldn't find her voice. "Your letters and packages kept me going," he said. At the broken gate in front of Le Jardin, he paused. She saw the house through his eyes, the tilted gate, the fallen wall, the dead apple tree that grew dirty scraps of cloth instead of bright red fruit. He pushed the gate out of the way. It clattered sideways, still connected to the crumbling post by a single unsteady screw and bolt. It creaked in protest at being touched. "Wait," she said. She had to tell him now, before it was too late. The whole town knew Nazis had billeted with Vianne. He would hear gossip for sure. If a baby was born in 8 months, they would suspect. It was hard without you, she began, trying to find her way. Le Jardin is so close to the airfield. The Germans noticed the house on their way into town. Two officers billeted here. The front door burst open and Sophie screamed, Papa! And came running across the yard. Antoine dropped awkwardly to one knee and opened his arms and Sophie ran into him. Vianne felt pain open up and expand. He was home, just as she'd prayed for, but she knew now that it wasn't the same. It couldn't be. He was changed. She was changed. She placed a hand on her flat belly. You are so grown up, Antoine said to his daughter. I left a little girl and came home to a young woman. You'll have to tell me what I missed. Sophie looked past him to Vianne. I don't think we should talk about the war, any of it, ever. It's over. Sophie wanted Vianne to lie. Danielle appeared in the doorway, dressed in short pants and a red-knit turtleneck that had lost its shape and socks that sagged over his ill-fitting second-hand shoes. Clutching a picture book to his narrow chest, he jumped down from the step and came toward him, frowning. "And who is this good-looking young man?" Antoine asked. "I'm Daniel," he said. "Who are you?" "I'm Sophie's father." Daniel's eyes widened. He dropped the book and threw himself at Antoine, yelling, Papa, you're home! Antoine scooped the boy into his arms and lifted him up. I'll tell you, Vianne said, but let's go inside now and celebrate. Vianne had fantasized about her husband's return from war 1,000 times. In the beginning, she'd imagined him dropping his suitcase at the side of her and sweeping her into his big, strong arms. And then Beck had moved into her home, making her feel things for a man, an enemy that even now she refused to name. When he told her of Antoine's imprisonment, she'd pared down her expectations. She'd imagined her husband thinner, more ragged-looking, but still Antoine when he returned. The man at her dinner table was a stranger. He hunched over his food and wrapped his arms around his plate, spooning marrow-bone broth into his mouth as if the meal were a timed event. When he realized what he was doing, he flushed guiltily and gave them a mumbled apology. Daniel talked constantly while Sophie and Vianne studied the shadow version of Antoine. He jumped at every sound and flinched when he was touched, and the pain in his eyes was impossible to miss. After supper, he put the children to bed while Vianne did the dishes alone. She was happy to let him go, which only increased her guilt. He was her husband, the love of her life, and yet, when he touched her, it was all she could do not to turn away. Now, standing at the window in her bedroom, she felt nervous as she awaited him. He came up behind her. She felt his strong, sure hands on her shoulders, heard him breathing behind her. She longed to lean back, rest her body against his with the familiarity that came from years together, but she couldn't. His hands caressed her shoulders, ran down her arms, and then settled on her hips. He gently turned her to face him. He eased the collar of her robe sideways and kissed her shoulder. You're so thin, he said, his voice hoarse with passion and something else, something new between them. Loss, maybe, an acknowledgment that change had occurred in their absence. I've gained weight since the winter, she said. Yeah, he said, me too. How did you escape? When they started losing the war, it got bad. They beat me so badly I lost the use of my left arm. I decided then I'd rather get shot running to you than be tortured to death. Once you're ready to die, the plan gets easy. Now was the time to tell him the truth. He might understand that rape was torture and that she'd been a prisoner, too. It wasn't her fault, what had happened to her. She believed that, but she didn't think fault mattered in a thing like this. He took her face in his hands and forced her to lift her chin. Their kiss was sad, an apology almost, a reminder of what they once shared. She trembled as he undressed her. She saw the red marks that crisscrossed his back and torso and the jagged, angry, puckering scars that ran the length of his left arm. She knew Antoine wouldn't hit her or hurt her, and still she was afraid. What is it, Vianne? He said, drawing back. She glanced at the bed. their bed, and all she could think about was him. Von Richter, while you were gone, do we need to talk about it? She wanted to confess it all, to cry in his arms, and he be comforted and told that it would be all right. But what about Antoine? He'd been through hell, too. She could see it in him. There were red, slashing scars on his chest that looked like whip marks. He loved her. She saw that, too, felt it. But he was a man. If she'd told him she'd been raped, and that another man's baby grew in her belly, it would eat at him. In time, he would wonder if she could have stopped Von Richter. Maybe someday he'd wonder if she'd enjoyed it. And there it was. She could tell him about Beck, even that she'd killed him, but she could never tell Antoine she'd been raped. This child in her belly would be born early. Children were born a month early all the time. She couldn't help wondering if the secret would destroy them either way. I could tell you all of it, she said quietly. Her tears were tears of shame and loss and love. Love, most of all. I could tell you about the German officers who built it here, and how hard life was, and how we barely survived, and how Sarah died in front of me, and how strong Rachel was when they put her on the cattle car, and how I promised to keep Ari safe. I could tell you how my father died, and Isabel was arrested and deported. But I think you know it all. God forgive me. And maybe there's no point talking about any of it. Maybe. She traced a red welt that ran like a lightning bolt down his left bicep. Maybe it's best to just forget the past and go on. He kissed her. When he drew back, his lips remained against hers. I love you, Vianne. She closed her eyes and returned his kiss, waiting for her body to come alive at his touch. But when she slid beneath him and felt their bodies come together, as they'd done so many times before, she felt nothing at all. I love you too, Antoine. She tried not to cry as she said it. A cold November night. Antoine had been home for almost 2 months. There had been no word from Isabel. Vianne couldn't sleep. She lay in bed beside her husband, listening to his quiet snore. It had never bothered her before, never kept her awake, but now it did. No, that wasn't true. She turned, lay on her side, and stared at him. In the darkness, with the light of a full moon coming through the window, he was unfamiliar, thin, sharp, gray-haired at 35. She inched out of bed and covered him with the heavy eiderdown that had been her grandma's. She put on her robe. Downstairs she wandered from room to room, looking for what? Her old life, perhaps? Or the love for a man she'd lost? Nothing felt right anymore. They were like strangers. He felt it, too. She knew he did. The war lay between them at night. She got a quilt from the living room trunk, wrapped it around herself, and went outside. A full moon hung over the room fields. Light fell in cracked patches on the ground below the apple trees. She went to the middle tree, stood beneath it. The dead black branch arched above her, leafless and gnarled. On it were all her scraps of twine and yarn and ribbon. When she tied the remembrances onto this branch, Vianne had naively thought that staying alive was all that mattered. The door behind her opened and closed quietly. She felt her husband's presence as she always had. Vianne, he said, coming up behind her. He put his arms around her. She wanted to lean back into him, but she couldn't do it. She stared at the first ribbon she tied to this tree, Antoine's. The color of it was as changed, as weathered, as they were. It was time. She couldn't wait any longer. Her belly was growing. She turned, looked up at him. Antoine was all she could say. I love you, Vianne. She drew in a deep breath and said, I'm going to have a baby. He went still. It was a long moment before he said, What? When? She stared up at him, remembering their other pregnancies, how they'd come together in loss and in joy. I'm almost 2 months along, I think. It must have happened that first night you were home. She saw every nuance of emotion in his eye, surprise, worry, concern, wonder, and finally, joy. He grazed her chin, tilted her face up. I know why you look so afraid, but don't worry, V. We won't lose this one, he said. Not after all of this. It's a miracle. Tears stung her eyes. She tried to smile, but her guilt was suffocating. You've been through so much. We all have. So we choose to see miracles. Was that his way of saying he knew the truth? Had suspicion planted itself? What would he say when the baby was born early? What do you mean? She saw tears glaze his eyes. I mean, forget the past, V. Now is what matters. We will always love each other. That's the promise we made when we were 14. By the pond, when I first kissed you. Remember? I remember. She was so lucky to have found this man. No wonder she had fallen in love with him. And she would find her way back to him, just as he'd found his way back to her. This baby will be our new beginning. Kiss me, she whispered. Make me forget. It's not forgetting we need, Vianne, he said, leaning down to kiss her. It's remembering. Chapter 36. In February 1945, snow covered the naked bodies piled outside the camp's newly built crematorium. Putrid black smoke roiled up from the chimneys. Isabel stood, shivering, in her place at the morning appel. Roll call. It was the kind of cold that ached in the lungs and froze eyelashes and burned fingertips and toes. She waited for the roll call to end, but no whistle blared. Snow was still falling. In the prisoners' ranks, some women started to cough. Another one pitched face first into the mushy, muddy snow and couldn't be raised. A bitter wind blew across the camp. Finally, an SS officer on horseback rode past the women, eyeing them one by one. He seemed to notice everything, the shorn hair, the flea bites, the blue tips of frostbitten fingers, and the patches that identified them as Jews or homosexuals or political prisoners. In the distance, bombs fell, exploded like distant thunder. When the officer pointed out a woman, she was immediately pulled from the line. He pointed at Isabel, and she was yanked nearly off her feet, dragged out of line. The SS squad surrounded the women who'd been chosen, forced them to form two lines. A whistle blared. Schnell! Eins, zwei, drei! Isabel marched forward, her feet aching with cold, her lungs burning. Micheline fell into step beside her. They had made it a mile or so outside of the gates when a lorry rumbled past them, its back heaped high with naked corpses. Micheline stumbled. Isabel reached out, holding her friend upright. And still they marched. At last they came to a snowy field, blanketed in fog. The Germans separated the women again. Isabel was yanked away from Micheline and pushed into a group of other knocked-on-nebbled political prisoners. The Germans shoved them together and shouted at them and pointed until Isabel understood. The woman beside her screamed when she saw what they'd been chosen for. Road crew. Don't, Isabel said, just as a truncheon hit the woman hard enough to send her sprawling. Isabel stood as numb as a plow mule as the Nazis slipped rough leather harness straps over her shoulders and tightened them at her waist. She was harnessed to 11 other young women, elbow to elbow. Behind them, attached to the harness, was a steel wheel the size of an automobile. Isabel tried to take a step, couldn't. A whip cracked across her back, setting her flesh on fire. She clutched the harness straps and tried again, taking a step forward. They were exhausted. They had no strength, and their feet were freezing on the snowy ground. But they had to move, or they'd be whipped. Isabel angled forward, straining to move, to get the stone wheel turning. The straps bit into her chest. One of the women stumbled, fell. The others kept pulling. The leather harness creaked, and the wheel turned. They pulled and pulled and pulled, creating a road from the snow-covered ground behind them. Other women used shovels and wheelbarrows to clear the way. All the while, the guards sat in pods, gathered around open fires, talking and laughing amongst themselves. Step. 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 Isabel couldn't think of anything else, not the cold, nor her hunger or thirst, not the flea and lice bites that covered her body, and not real life. That was the worst of all. The thing that would get her to miss a step, to draw attention to herself, to be hit or whipped or worse. Step. Just think about moving. Her leg gave out. She crumbled to the snow. The woman beside her reached out. Isabel grabbed the shaking blue-white hand, gripped it in her numb fingers, and crawled back to stand. Gritting her teeth, she took another painful step, and then another. The siren went off at 3 a.m. as it did every morning for roll call. Like her 9 bunkmates, Isabel slept in every bit of clothing she had, ill-fitting shoes and underwear, the baggy striped dress with her prisoner identification number sewn on the sleeve. But none of it provided warmth. She tried to encourage the women around her to hold strong, but she herself was weakening. It had been a terrible winter. All of them were dying, some quickly of typhus and cruelty, and some slowly of starvation and cold, but all were dying. Isabel had had a fever for weeks, but not high enough to send her to the hospital block, and last week she'd been beaten so badly she'd lost consciousness at work, and then she'd been beaten for falling down. Her body, which couldn't have weighed more than 80 pounds, was crawling with lice and covered in open sores. Ravensbrück had been dangerous from the beginning, but now, in March 1945, it was even more so. Hundreds of women had been killed or gassed or beaten in the last month. The only women who had been left alive were the Verfügungsbaren, the disposables, who were sick or frail or elderly, and the women of Nacht und Nebel, night and fog, political prisoners like Isabel and Micheline, women of the resistance. The rumor was that the Nazis were afraid to gas them now that the tide of war had turned. You're going to make it. Isabel realized she'd been weaving in place, beginning to fall. Micheline Babineau gave her a tired, encouraging smile. Don't cry. I'm not crying, Isabel said. They both knew that the women who cried at night were the women who died in the morning. Sadness and loss were drawn in with each breath, but never expelled. You couldn't give in, not for a second. Isabel knew this. In the camp, she fought back the only way she knew how, by caring for her fellow prisoners and helping them to stay strong. All they had in this hell was each other. In the evenings, they crouched in their dark bunks, whispering amongst themselves, singing softly, trying to keep alive some memory of who they'd been. Over the 9 months Isabel had been here, she had found and lost too many friends to count. But Isabel was tired now and sick. Pneumonia, she was pretty sure, and typhus, maybe. She coughed quietly and did her job and tried to draw no attention. The last thing she wanted was to end up in the tent, a small brick building with tarp walls, into which the Nazis put any woman with an incurable disease. It was where women went to die. Stay alive, Isabel said softly. Micheline nodded encouragingly. They had to stay alive, now more than ever. Last week, new prisoners had come with news. The Russians were advancing across Germany, smashing and defeating the Nazi army. Auschwitz had been liberated. The Allies were said to be winning one victory after another in the West. A race for survival was on, and everyone knew it. The war was ending. Isabel had to stay alive long enough to see an Allied victory and a free France. A whistle blared at the front of the line. A hush fell over the crowd of prisoners, women mostly, and a few children. In front of them, a trio of SS officers paced with their dogs. The camp commandant appeared in front of them. He stopped and clasped his hands behind his back. He called out something in German, and the SS officers advanced. Isabel heard the words, Nacht und Nebel. An SS officer pointed at her, and another one pushed through the crowd, knocking women to the ground, stepping on or over them. He grabbed Isabel's skinny arm and pulled hard. She stumbled along beside him, praying her shoes wouldn't fall off. It was a whipping offense to lose a shoe, and if she did, she'd spend the rest of this winter with a bare, frostbitten foot. Not far away, she saw Micheline being dragged off by another officer. All Isabel could think was that she needed to keep her shoes on. An SS officer called out a word Isabel recognized. They were being sent to another camp. No, she muttered. talking to herself had become a way of life. For months, as she stood in line at work, doing something that repelled and horrified her, she whispered to herself. As she sat on a hole in a row of pit toilets, surrounded by other women with dysentery, staring at the women sitting across from her, trying not to gag on the stench of their bowel movements, she whispered to herself. In the beginning, it had been stories she told herself about the future, memories she shared with herself about the past. Now it was just words, gibberish sometimes, anything to remind herself that she was human and alive. We have come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.